funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Have you found your God yet? When former NPR and New York Times correspondent Eric Weiner first encountered that question, it was whispered in his ear by a caring nurse who saw how frightened he was during an emergency hospitalization. Fortunately, the illness resolved itself with no lasting effects, but Weiner found it harder to shake the nurse's question and eventually decided to travel the globe to meet practitioners of a sampling of world religions, hoping to resolve for himself the question of what kind of God, if any, he could put his faith in. He writes about his journey in his new book, Man Seeks God, My Flirtations with the Divine. Eric, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris. Happy to be here.
So let's talk about this day when you believed your life might very well be in danger. It wasn't simply the question about whether you had faith that really touched you, but the way the nurse phrased it. What made that so striking?
Well, her exact words, as you said, were, "Have you found your God yet?" Not, "Have you found God?" or "Have you found a God?" but "Have you found your God?" As if there was, you know, sort of this notion of spiritual compatibility, and there was one God out there for me. And as you said, I thankfully was not in grave danger. I was discharged from the hospital, but that question did haunt me. And again, this notion of spiritual compatibility is actually pretty relevant today, because so many of us will change our religious affiliation over the course of our lifetimes, one out of three. We are really increasingly so a nation of God hoppers, if you will, sort of trying on new faiths. And that's what I did in a sort of speeded up and more extreme version. But really what I did was not that different from what all of us are doing in one form or another, and that's looking for a faith that fits.
You write sort of humorously that your family was not especially religious growing up. You describe yourselves as gastronomic Jews.
We were, absolutely. It was all about the bagels and lox and the gefilte fish. And, you know, if you could eat it, then it was Jewish and had something to do with God, maybe. But that was about it. It's funny, but it's true. I grew up, as many Jewish and many Christian people do in this country, largely secular. You know, we went to synagogue maybe once a year. I was in the sort of most cursory of ways exposed to Judaism, and that exposure, to be honest, kind of put me off. Mm-hmm. I found it overly rigid, and I didn't find it that relevant to my life. Growing up in suburban Baltimore, I had all kinds of issues, and my religion didn't seem relevant to those issues.
You know what's so interesting, though? You write that you have never much liked the term agnostic, because in your mind it refers to someone who doesn't know for sure whether there's a God, and by implication doesn't much care if there's a God.
That's what I've come to believe, that the term agnostic is, it's insufficient. It's just, it's not a good description, I think. It doesn't do justice to those of us out there who are looking for something. We don't know what that something is. Maybe it's God, maybe it's not, but it's the notion that we believe or we hope that there's more to this world than meets the eye, and we're active about it. You know, we're doing things. We're taking meditation classes. We're taking yoga. We're praying. We're reading. Agnostic strikes me as a very passive sort of way of being, and I don't think that's the way most people are who, by default, might call themselves agnostic.
And in the past, you had been a big fan of self-help books, which in some ways would seem to appeal to the seeker within anybody.
It's true. I am a self in need of help, I suppose.
as we all are.
I've got a towering bookshelf of them, and my wife is embarrassed by them. So when dinner guests come over, she insists I hide them in the basement. One of my favorite lines comes from Joseph Campbell, that great student of myth. Mm-hmm. When he was asked what his spiritual practice was, he said, "I underline books." And that was, and still is me. I've never met a book I didn't find something worth underlining or dog-earing or molesting in some other way. And I realized, though, that's fine. That's great. Reading is great. But I'm a head-based person, and I've been stuck in my head for 40-plus years now, and when I set out on this journey, I made a conscious decision to read, yes, but to do more than just read, and to try to actually experience these eight different religions as directly as possible.
So let's talk about making the choices of those eight religions, because when you go to look for God through the eyes of believers, you have, I was astonished to read this, 9,900 religions in the world right now, more being added every day. How did you pick the ones you did?
Very carefully. It wasn't easy. I started with the process of elimination. I eliminated, religions that don't take converts, for instance. The Zoroastrians, for instance, a very ancient and fascinating faith, but they do not accept converts. I eliminated religions that seemed overly narrow, such as Hungarian folk religion, since I'm neither Hungarian nor folksy. I scratched that one off. And then I started to hone in on ones that appealed to me, that would help me get out of my head, and that would mean largely mystical traditions. So not all of Judaism, but Kabbalah, the mystical arm of Judaism. Not all of Islam, but Sufism, the mystical part of Islam. And I also was looking for kind of a cross-section of, what are the different ways that we can come at this thing called God or religion or faith, whatever you want to call it. So I came up with a list of eight that included, a smattering of monotheistic faiths such as Judaism and Catholicism and Islam, and polytheistic ones like Wicca or neo-paganism, and even atheistic religions, and there is such a thing, religions that don't believe in a supreme being such as Buddhism and Taoism. And I think it was a pretty good cross-section. Ultimately, it's going to be an imperfect selection, but it's what appealed to me and what represented the sort of broad spectrum of belief out there.
So I noticed in that list you didn't mention the one that probably raises the most eyebrows among people who read the book, and that's Raelism.
Yes, I knew you were going to say that. yes, the Raelians are the only faith in there that's really not new, unless you consider 1974, 75 new. That's when it was founded. They are a relatively small but somewhat popular group, and they believe that we were created by aliens some 25,000 years ago. And I did attend one of their annual conferences in Las Vegas. And I just want to say that I took them seriously, and I actually, while I did not end up becoming a Raelian, found that there was actually much to be learned from the way they were practicing their faith. So it was... was it a fun chapter? Yes. But was it just comic relief? No. I had a serious point there.
Yeah, one thing that you found appealing about the Raelians is that they really don't have a problem with embracing pleasure, which is something that a lot of religions really frown on.
Right. It got me thinking. I mean, here is a faith, and they are, according to the IRS, a legitimate religion, that embraces the notion of pleasure. They believe that we were created in order to have as much pleasure as possible. And of course, at first we sort of smirk at that, thinking, well, that's not a real religion, but why not? Why do we always associate a religious life with one of deprivation? And so it allowed me to explore that possibility, and ultimately in the end I should say that I rejected the Raelians not because I found them odd, although I did, but because pleasure is not enough. We really want more from our religions. We want to be challenged by our faith. That's why you see a rising popularity of Calvinism, for instance, which is a very strict form of Christianity, or Buddhism even. If you've ever tried to sit and meditate and watch your breath for more than 5 seconds, you realize how hard that is, and that's hugely popular. So I think it's fascinating and somewhat heartening that of all these religions out there, we're not choosing the newfangled hedonistic ones for the most part. We're choosing ones that require us to really work hard.
You're open here about the fact that throughout your adult life, you have suffered off and on from a sort of persistent low-grade depression, which you think may be linked to your fear of death. And it occurs to me that in many ways, a belief in God or in a religion is sort of the ultimate cure for the fear of our immortality.
Well, it is if you believe in the afterlife, and it is to some extent if, you, like Buddhists and Hindus, you believe in reincarnation. But more than that, when I met religious people around the world, and I met some fascinating ones, they didn't really talk about that. They didn't say, well, my religion provides me some succor knowing that in after death I know what happens. Mm-hmm. It was more that it helped them in everyday ways, actually in very practical ways. And time and time again, I was amazed by this. I met people who have converted or deepened their faith, and they talk about being less angry, That was one thing that came up a lot. They were angry before, and they're less angry now, or they're less depressed. But it's more the here and now, and actually less, you know, religion is sort of an insurance policy against death, if you will.
You don't explain in the book how you made initial contact with the people that you spent time with. And I'm curious as to how open people were and whether they trusted the benevolence of your intentions in going in and spending time with them, and if they were really heavy about trying to convert you. How did that all work?
That's a really good question, and one I haven't had before. I'll tell you, you know, as a former correspondent for NPR for many years, I developed a sort of toolkit, as any journalist does, in terms of how to make contact. You know, a friend of mine calls it the golden thread. You ask one person, you tell them you're looking for Wiccans, and they say, well, try so-and-so and try so-and-so, and 3, 4, 5 degrees down the line, you have an introduction, and introductions are hugely important. That'll get your foot in the door. But, you know, they may have viewed me suspiciously at first. You know, who is this sort of middle-aged hypochondriac, slightly depressed former journalist looking for God, maybe, you know?
That's not on your business cards.
Yeah, it's a long, very big business card, actually, to get all that to fit in there. But the truth is, despite my humor, which is there in the book, and as you've probably detected, this was also a serious search, and people pick up on that.
Yeah,
I mean, you can't fake that, and as much as you may have the right contacts, ultimately, when people talk to you on the phone or meet you in person, they have a sense of whether you're serious about this or not. And, you know, no one really tried to convert me. The Raelians didn't, and they didn't ask me for any money out there in Las Vegas. The Franciscans in the South Bronx, who I spent time with, didn't really try to convert me. People were very open, and they were sharing, and I was impressed with a lot of the people I met out there. I have to say I changed my opinion about what quote-unquote religious people were like. I think as a sort of East Coast, without sounding, elitist, intellectual, or whatever you want to call that, I had a certain view that religious people were somehow more narrow-minded and in some way not as intellectually curious as, you know, us people who underline books. And and I've changed that, I would say, 180 degrees. I found people who are exceptionally intelligent and exceptionally skeptical, filled with doubts, actually, but still people of great faith. And then doubt and faith, I've concluded, are not polar opposites. They're actually very compatible.
What do you think makes it hard in some cases for, let's say, intellectuals, according to your definition, and people of faith to communicate effectively?
They're not mutually
exclusive.
They're not. That's a tough question. I hate to get political, but I think that religion has become so politicized in this country that people don't want to be associated with this religion or that religion for fear of being associated with one political grouping or another. I think that is one of the problems. And I think another sort of deeper problem is that we're asking religion to do the wrong thing in this country. We're sometimes asking, or not asking, how do I put this? We perceive religion as perhaps a substitute for science or a threat to science, when really, and this is not an original idea of my own, but I'll paraphrase here from I believe Terry Eagleton, to say that, you know, now that we have science, we don't need religion, is like saying now that we have the toaster oven, we don't need Chekhov or Shakespeare. They're not
apples and oranges.
Yeah, they're not. We need both. You know, you need your toaster oven in the morning, and you need your Shakespeare in the afternoon. And I think it's when we look at it as an either-or proposition. Either there's religion or science, either there's faith or reason.
Let me jump in here. We have to take a break. Eric Weiner is my guest. His new book is called Man Seeks God, My Flirtations with the Divine. We'll be right back.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. Learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is author Eric Weiner. He is a former reporter for NPR and The New York Times. His new book is called Man Seeks God, My Flirtations with the Divine. If you'd like to join us, the number is 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. So, Eric, you started your search with Sufism, which, perhaps not surprisingly, is a very different thing in Mendocino, California than it is in Istanbul.
Yes, I quickly discovered that. I signed up for something called Sufi Camp. I guess I was drawn to the wonderful juxtaposition of those two words, Sufi and camp. And it was in Mendocino, California. And, you know, it was fine. It was fun, but it didn't... It was much more camp than Sufi, mm-hmm. Let's put it that way. It was this sort of melange of a little bit of Japanese tea ceremony, some Buddhist mantras, some yoga, and a bit of Sufism thrown in. And I realized at that point that religions are a lot like cuisines. They don't always travel well mm-hmm. across long distances. They get watered down. They get a bit mushy. And I made a decision after a few days in Sufi camp to go to the source of these religions as much as possible. So I got on an airplane and I flew to Turkey, which is certainly one of the sources for this thing we call Sufism. It's Turkey's home to Rumi, the mystical poet, and Turkey is where the whirling dervishes first took flight.
I definitely want to talk to you more about those experiences, but why do you think the California version of Sufism was almost entirely divorced from Islam?
Well, I think that, let's be honest here, all religions come with a lot of baggage, and Islam is not carry-on size. It's definitely checked luggage. There's a lot of baggage, a lot of misperceptions and ideas that we all bring to it, and I think people want to extract the part of Islam that they find appealing, which is Sufism, which is all about heart and love and divine love, and it's quite wonderful, mm-hmm. But divorce it from Islam. Now, I realize that there, without getting into this in any great depth, there is somewhat of an academic dispute about did the Sufis predate Islam, that these lovers of God, as they call themselves, always existed and then were brought into the Islamic fold. I don't know the answer to that, but I do know that the Muslims I spoke with around the world all found it a bit odd, to put it mildly, that you could be a Sufi and not be a Muslim.
You know, I knew a bit of Rumi's wonderful poetry, but not a great deal about his life story. I was really surprised to discover reading this book that he didn't particularly like expressing himself through poetry, but essentially was providing what people needed to understand this faith.
Yeah, that surprised me too. He was, I call him the reluctant poet. Hmm. Or at least, you know, maybe he was feigning it, but that's what he said and what he wrote. People came by and they wanted poems, so he provided them. It was a form of service in a way. But he was an amazing larger-than-life figure, and he was so ebullient and so... his poetry is so romantic, really, mm-hmm. Although he's talking about love of God and not romantic love as we think of it today.
He also saw depression, which is, you know, somewhat salient to your situation, as a path to melt into God.
Yes. And there are different views about the relationship between depression and spirituality. You know, in some traditions, some people will believe that it's a real impediment, that sadness is going to get in the way of you having a divine experience. And others, Rumi included, believe that it's a sort of warning call. It's like if your knee hurts, that's a good thing because it means you're going to go to the doctor and have it looked at, and that depression and perhaps other psychological ailments are not necessarily a dis-ease, but a similar kind of warning sign that you need to do something about it. And, you know, I have to admit, I never really met anyone who became deeply spiritual because they were just happy all the time and decided to, you know, find God and find religion. It's usually a crisis of some kind, or sometimes it's achieving all kinds of wonderful success in, you know, in the material world, but not being fully satisfied. So there's almost always something missing or something that's off kilter that leads people to these searches.
What is the spiritual experience of a whirling dervish?
It's unbelievable. I have to say. Have you ever seen it?
I've seen it, but I only on television, not in person.
Okay, TV doesn't count in this case. But I witnessed one on the outskirts of Istanbul, and some of them are these days designed for tourists. This one was not. This was very much, I was the only non-Turkish person there. It is both very active on the one hand, in that these dervishes are spinning sort of on their own axis and sort of rotating almost in a planetary way around each other. And at the same time, it's very contemplative. And if you look at their faces, they are so serene as they're turning. And they have one hand down in this world, and the other hand is up in the next world, is the idea. And it is not a dance, and they don't really call it a dance or even a performance. It is prayer. It is prayer in motion, and I've never seen anything like it. I found it compelling and inspiring.
And you tried to do it.
I did. Again, I wanted to get out of my head.
Yeah.
So I told a Sufi friend of mine, Dilek, I want to turn, and she's, you know, took one look at my business card, neurotic, hypochondriac, get the rest of it.
The former said, journalist, right. Yeah.
Yes, thank you. She said this isn't going to be easy because Sufism in Turkey is still somewhat underground and they don't just accept anybody. But mm-hmm. She was persistent, my friend Dilek, and she found a teacher for me and I tried it. And I was just awful at first. I must have looked like a drunken elephant. It's extremely difficult to do. But I persisted and made some progress.
Hmm. And so you had a somewhat spiritual experience in doing this?
For about 15 seconds.
Uh-huh. But you felt something for those 15 seconds.
I did. And then, of course, I announced to those who were watching me, I'm doing it, I'm turning, and then fell on my face.
Mm-hmm.
Because I had made the cardinal mistake that Rumi advises against. I had analyzed enthusiasm, and he said, never analyze enthusiasm. You know, it's that idea that you're in the moment, and then you become aware of your happiness or this blissful state you're in, and that immediately takes you out of it.
Let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Mark on the line in Arlington. Hello, Mark.
Greetings. It's great to talk to you, Mr. Weiner.
Good to speak with you.
I just finished your book, Geography of Bliss, last week, and found myself actually laughing out loud in quite a few places.
You're one book behind.
I know. I'm going to this one next.
Okay, thank you.
And that was my question. How do you see the two books maybe overlapping in places? And secondly, which one of these book writing experiences touched you more?
Good questions, both. You know, in a way, I saw the book about God, Man Seeks God, as an extension of the book about happiness. Because one statistic I kept stumbling over when I was researching the geography of bliss was this, that religious people are, across the board, consistently happier than people who are not religious. And this is true in survey after survey, and I wondered why that is. Is it, as my atheist friends would have it, because ignorance is bliss, or are the religious onto something? So it seemed like a natural extension to do that. I would say this second book touched me more deeply, simply because spirituality and God is deeper than happiness. And I sort of conclude really at the end of my first book that we want more than happiness. You know, we say we just want to be happy, we just want our children to be happy, but really we want more than that. We want meaningful lives. And it seems to me that that science doesn't always provide that meaning, and that religion, I just want to be clear here, when I say religion, I mean religion as a kind of applied philosophy of how to get through every day provides that. So I hope that answers your questions.
Do you believe, having gone to Kathmandu of other places, that there are, in fact, physical locations on the planet that are, for whatever reason, more spiritual than others?
You know, Christy, the Irish call these thin places.
Mm-hmm.
The idea is they're places where the distance between heaven and earth is compressed.
Yeah.
And you're closer to the transcendent, the divine, whatever you want to call it. And I absolutely do believe that. And they're not always the obvious places. They might be, you know, some pilgrimage site high in the Himalayas. But it might be a bookstore that you really love. It might be some place like that. I believe that there are places that just are more conducive to have, and I'm sorry if this sounds cliched, but a spiritual breakthrough. And maybe that's just me, but I'm very much a creature of geography.
No, well, what's interesting about the way you see that is that there's room for it to be individual to certain people. I have a friend who goes into the forest and really feels like it's a transcendent experience almost every time. For someone else, it might be somewhere totally different.
And it might be not just the forest or the mountains. It might be a city.
Mm-hmm.
This is something else I've concluded. We tend to think of nature as being divine and cities as being whatever the...
Contaminated somehow.
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. The opposite of divine.
Mm-hmm.
I realize how much in these journeys I was in cities, large ones like Istanbul and Kathmandu, which is a pretty big city, and smaller ones like Tzfat in northern Israel. And Christianity grew up in cities, not in the countryside, really. And cities can be very divine places as well.
Talk a little bit about, as you started to explore Buddhism, you had to really confront the nature of your own suffering and concluded that in many cases it was sort of neurotic and artificial, and that made you feel even worse.
Yes, because if you go to a country like Nepal, you see genuine suffering,
mm-hmm.
people who don't have enough to eat or can't send their kids to school. And let's face it, the kind of suffering I'm talking about is a sort of existential luxury that we have in the West.
Yeah.
And, of course, that made me feel guilty, and therefore I suffered more. But, you know, that's my own neuroses at work. The first of the Four Noble Truths in Buddhism is simply that all is suffering. And people hear that, as I did, and I thought, well, first of all, I thought, well, here's the religion for me. They seem to really get me.
Yeah.
But people often misinterpret, and I did too, Buddhism as being a sort of pessimistic religion.
Yeah, people hear that and think, well, I'm out of there.
Right, all mm-hmm. is suffering and I'm out of there. But they don't realize that step two is that there's a cause for that suffering, and that is excessive desire.
Mm-hmm.
And step three is that there's a cure for that suffering. So the Buddha very much saw himself as a kind of physician, sort of diagnosing the human ailment, all is suffering, and prescribing a cure, which is basically a course of meditation, contemplation.
Mm-hmm. And the story of the Buddha is so interesting because this was like this spoiled rich kid, essentially, who had an awakening.
Mm-hmm. He was a prince. He had it all, and he led a very sheltered life. His father insisted on it. He rarely got outside of the palace. And when he did sort of sneak out one day, or so legend has it, he saw things that blew him away. He saw sick people. He saw a corpse. And he realized the impermanence of life and the suffering that was out there, and he snuck away one evening and never returned home.
What was your experience with meditation? Because this is not an easy thing for most people to do who haven't practiced before.
It's not easy, and this is where, you know, meditation is billed properly so, I believe, as a sort of cure for stress and all that. But what they don't tell you is in order to get to that de-stressed state of mind, you have to go through a lot of turmoil first,
mm-hmm.
because the first step is you become aware of how much of a monkey mind, as they call it, you have. Because if you were to stop and sit still right now for 5 minutes, we won't do it because it'll just sound like dead air, I guess, for 5 minutes, you would realize how much your mind sort of jumps around from one thought to another, and it's sort of out of control. And so the first step of meditation is really kind of disheartening in a way, because you realize, oh my God, my mind is all over the place. It is just jumping around. And you try to work through that and just stay with the process.
Let's go back to the phones now. The number is 1-800-933-5372. We have Royce on the line in Dallas. Hello, Royce.
Good afternoon.
Hi.
Hi. A quick question, and I very much appreciate the program. Harkening back to your earlier comment about the open welcome that you received from people of so many different beliefs and faiths, did you find, as I often have, that when you began to explore, if you did indeed, began to explore the difference between their personal beliefs and practices and adherences involved with those faiths, and the larger perspective in historicity, the effects of their faith worldwide. Did you find a difference in the welcomeness of your questions?
I don't not entirely. I don't quite understand the question.
Well, my experience has been if I ask an individual about faith, they have certain things that they adhere to and believe in, which I often find to be quite valuable, and admirable. But if I ask about in history, the historical implications of their faith in terms of imposing it upon other people.
I understand your question. It's sort of the difference between the micro version of faith and the macro version. You know, I was really very much interested in the personal, you know, in how people experience their faith personally. Because once you start getting into that second area of faith and religion that you're discussing, you're into a whole other realm, an important realm. I don't mean to diminish it. You know, it's been said that religion is spirituality plus politics. Hmm. And I think there is some truth to that. And I think everyone, you know, that's the thing about religion is it is both very personal and deeply personal. And on the other hand, it's very public as well because you're part of a larger community. I was interested for the most part in the personal, in how these faiths shaped people personally and which might be the right one for me.
Author Eric Weiner is my guest. He's a former reporter for NPR and The New York Times. His newest book is called Man Seeks God, My Flirtations with the Divine. You can join the conversation by calling in to 1-800-933-5372. We can also be reached via email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. Learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Former NPR reporter, now author Eric Weiner is my guest. His new book is called Man Seeks God, My Flirtations with the Divine. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. Email address is think@kera.org. We have an email here from Sean who writes, "You don't seem as concerned with the truth of religion as you are with religion's ability to make you feel better. Is the truth about the existence of a personal God important to you?"
Boy, that is a good question. I am a big fan of a, and this is my attempt to answer the question, mm-hmm. of a quote by William James, who was sort of the very first person to sort of chronicle religious experience in this country about 100 years ago. He said, "Truth is what works." And I find that to be actually a very useful thing, since, you know, truth is such a slippery thing. And even in science, today's truth becomes tomorrow's, you know, discarded truth. I think that if we approach religion that way, that if it not only makes us feel better, but actually makes us better people, if it makes us happier, if it makes us more willing to volunteer and help others, then I think you could say the religion is true in the sense that William James meant. And so I would love if some metaphysical truth about the existence of God descended on me one day. But in the meantime, I'm quite happy, I think, to pursue that William Jamesian approach that religion that can make us better people is true in one sense of the word.
So when you went to look at Catholicism, you looked very specifically at, you spent time with Franciscan friars living in the Bronx. And what was so interesting about that account is how liberated they seem to have been by the fact of their poverty.
I know, isn't that fascinating?
Yeah.
Because when I got there, I heard about, you know, these friars who had taken vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience. You know, that's not, we don't, most of us don't think of that as the trifecta of fun. You know? I mean, and so I just sort of assumed that they were miserable, mm-hmm. but determined, that they woke up every day saying, oh, I wish I had the latest, you know, iPad 2 or something. But in fact, that was not the case. They took these vows voluntarily, of course. And as one of the friars explained to me, he said, look, you know, we don't own anything, so we don't have to worry about anyone stealing our stuff. We don't have to worry about upgrading to stuff 2.0 or envying the guy down the road who has better stuff. And the way they described it, it did sound very liberating, because they've taken themselves out of that rat race.
Talk a little bit about your experience with mystery and religion. And several of the faiths you looked at are sort of, I don't know that they're deliberately obscure, but you have to work to get whatever the truth is that may be revealed.
Right. And I think it comes down to how we use and perceive the word mystery. Now, these days, we tend to think of a mystery as something to be solved. In a way, a mystery is a problem. But a lot of these faiths, especially the ones that, you know, sort of go back many thousands of years, they view mystery as not a bad thing, necessarily. A mystery is not a riddle to be solved. A mystery is something that provokes awe in us, the great mystery, as it's often called. And I think that's a different way of approaching it. And I think it's something to think about.
You know, it's funny. We talk so often in modern life about the conflict or perceived conflict between science and religion. And whether you perceive that or not, it does seem like the age of science has made mystery intolerable to us.
Right. It's a problem. It's an impediment. We need to get rid of it, get it out of the way. But if you think about the moments in your life where maybe you felt the presence of something transcendent or something that took your breath away, it was probably often there was an element of mystery to it. You had a certain feeling, you didn't know why, and it was that mystery element that sort of amplified the sensation. You know, I'm not saying that all mysteries are good. The mystery of cancer is, I believe, one obviously that we should solve as quickly as possible. But the mystery of a beautiful sunset is one that we should not be trying to solve, but one we should be trying to enjoy in the biggest sense of the word.
Eric, tell us just a little bit about what you learned about Wicca, because this is one of those misunderstood belief systems that once you sort of get into it and unpack it, I think a lot of people might find a lot less threatening than they currently do.
Right. Again, it's that baggage problem I talked about earlier. You know, witchcraft, as it's sometimes called, or Wicca, comes with a whole lot of baggage. To even say that I dabbled in witchcraft, you know, sounds dangerous. And
you can't run for Congress now.
And no, I can't. Well, there are all kinds of reasons why I can't do that. that's a good one. I'll tell you briefly what I found fascinating about them is that it's their approach to ritual. They have these really elaborate rituals, and I attended a coven of Wiccans or witches in the Pacific Northwest, and we're around the large fire, and we're in a circle, always in a circle, and it was very almost Shakespearean. They're sort of reenacting these scenes where certain ancient gods, plural, are present, and it was almost like watching a piece of theater. And afterwards, I said to my Wiccan friend Jamie, that was amazing, that ritual. How old is that? And she said, oh, about 6 months old. Hmm. And then she added, we're still working on it. She said, at one point she told me there's a lot of bad ritual out there. And I thought, well, what do you mean by bad ritual? To me, that would mean flubbing your lines in church or synagogue, getting it wrong.
Yeah.
And she said, no, it's the content. It's ritual that doesn't elevate you, that doesn't inspire you. So because Wicca is really a new religion on top of an old one, they're with all due respect, they're making it up as they're going along, and that is actually a wonderful thing because they're creating these rituals. While when we go to church or synagogue or a mosque, we're simply, in some respects, going through the motions of something that's very old that we haven't had any input into.
And in terms, yeah, absolutely. And in terms of good acts or bad, the belief of Wiccans is that you get it back threefold. If you've put good out into the world, or if you've put bad out into the world, it comes back to you.
This is what I call karma adjusted for inflation. yes, and that is common in a lot of religions. This idea that whatever we do does come back to us in some form. The Wiccans are very explicit about it, as are Buddhists with the notion of karma. It's the idea that our personal actions determine our future life.
So, having grown up even as a nominal Jew, talk about why you wanted to look at a facet of Judaism last.
Well, this was probably the hardest one for me to write, because where I am circling back full circle to my own faith, and talk about baggage. I've got plenty. I have feelings of guilt for not being a quote-unquote better Jew.
Mm-hmm.
And it just seemed naturally that would be the last one that I would visit. Returning home in a way, somewhat reluctantly. And I have to be honest, I was hoping to sort of cross off the Judaism box fairly quickly. I wasn't expecting to be moved or touched by it, again, because of all this baggage, but I was surprised.
You write in a way that you write about Guy de Maupassant talking about the Eiffel Tower and eating lunch there every day. Can you sort of explain that metaphor
for us? This is a French writer in the 19th century, and he despised the Eiffel Tower, and he would, you know, sure, I think he was living when it was erected, and he just hated it. But he would have lunch every day in a cafe that was right in the base of the Eiffel Tower. And his friends asked him and said, "Why do you do that?" And he said, "Well, it's the only place where I don't have to look at the Eiffel Tower." and that seemed to me a pretty good metaphor for my relationship with Judaism. And in a way, I was too close to it, yet not looking at it.
So what did you find in Kabbalah that was different from what you knew of Judaism before?
Well, for one thing, it was not about the rules, per se, and it was not about the head, at least not the head only. It's very much about the heart. It is intuitive. It's also complicated, I should add. What really impressed me was not so much the study of Kabbalah, but the people I met who were studying it in this town in northern Israel. They were sort of freelance Jews, sort of taking a little bit from here and a little bit from there, and sort of cobbling together a faith that was recognizably Jewish, but was just more intuitive and more heart-based than anything I had ever experienced.
Yeah, that's very interesting, because so often we are told that we should, you know, really embrace religion in a personal way, and yet the rules in so many cases have been set down for so long that we don't feel qualified to do so.
Right, and that's the problem, if you will, with some of the older, more established religions, is they've become set in their ways, and anyone who attempts to, say, you know, change the rules might be accused of blasphemy. And Kabbalah is controversial. I mean, an Orthodox rabbi was once asked what he thought of Kabbalah, and he said, "I think it is nonsense, but it is Jewish nonsense, so we have to take it seriously," which is funny, but true. It's sort of the attitude. And in all of the mystical traditions, whether it's in Christianity, Islam, or Judaism, are viewed with some suspicion by the authorities in that religion. Yet all three of these religions are deeply rooted in a sort of mystical personal experience.
Did you become more comfortable with yourself as a seeker through this process?
I did. But I also conclude that sort of perpetual seeking is probably not a great way to be. I got a sense of this in California, people who really don't make any commitment to any one faith, and if something gets too hard, they move on to another. I sort of settled on what I call an IKEA God, some assembly required.
Mm-hmm.
If you've ever tried to put together a piece of IKEA furniture, you know it's not easy.
Yeah.
The instructions are not great, and the whole enterprise might collapse because you need a foundation. And it was actually, it was a friend of mine I met with in Jerusalem named Yossi Klein Halevi, who's an amazing man. And he heard, this was toward the end of my journey, and he heard about everywhere I'd been and everything I did. And he said, "That's great." But he said, "Religion is a language of intimacy with God, and you need to speak one fluently before you can learn others."
Hmm.
And that stuck with me. He said, basically, it's one thing to be a seeker, it's another thing to be a dilettante. And I'm not sure where the line is exactly, but I think it's an important line.
Are you certain you believe in God now?
I'm not. I have to be honest. But I'm certain in my desire to believe, and even more important, to experience, because I really think, and no offense to your question, but it is a common question. It's our default question in this country. Do you believe in God? What do you believe? And I discovered in a lot of religions around the world, that question doesn't come up. People
right.
are not interested in it. And no Buddhist said to me, what do you believe? They care about what I experience, mm-hmm. what I do, what I practice. And so we get very hung up on belief in this country, when, in a way, it's the experience of a religious life that's more important.
So do you think it's a fool's errand to try and for theistic religions to define God?
I'm sorry, what was the question?
I mean, is it a fool's errand to try and define God?
Yes, because I tried to do that early in the book and found so many definitions. Nietzsche said God is dead, and Woody Allen said not only does God not exist, but try finding a plumber on Saturday. There's all kinds of definitions. It is almost impossible, but I have one that has stuck with me, which I really like. It's from the Austrian poet Rainer Maria Rilke, and he said, God is a direction, and I like that mm-hmm. because, you know, you don't arrive at a direction. You head in a direction, and you can't really hold a direction in your hand, can you? But yet, it's there. It exists, and that's the one of all that I've read that has stuck with me.
What about as a parent, someone who is expected to take your child in some direction? What have you done with questions about what to say about the nature of our existence and of God?
Right, because children ask the really difficult questions, don't they?
Yeah.
Right? You know, the other day my daughter asked, you know, is God responsible for us? Questions like that, and she's only 5 years old, or she was at the time. You know, when I started writing this book, I was of the mind that I was going to raise my daughter to be whatever she wants. I was going to expose her to all these religious traditions and say, here, Sonia, you choose. I've concluded that that's a mistake, that 5, 6, 7, 8, these ages are too young to make those sort of decisions. So we are sending her to Hebrew school, but the other night we also went to a Sufi zikr, which is a kind of, it means literally remembrance, it's a Sufi ritual, and she was fine with that. She got that. So I think, again, if you want to convey something religious to your children, you need to base them and ground them in something, but hopefully that something, you know, doesn't stick them to the ground. In other words, that they have the freedom later to add or subtract pieces from the whole.
The new book by Eric Weiner is called Man Seeks God, My Flirtations with the Divine. Eric, it's been a great conversation. Thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Thanks, Chris. This was fantastic.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bilotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. And our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about Think, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcast at kera.org/think. You can email comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.